And our special guest tonight, Peter Fairfield. We're talking about his work, Deep Happy. Let's take some of your stories, your questions. I want to know when you were happy, when you were not. Let's figure it out when we come right back. Peter, you talk about the difference between some kind of emotion and other areas. What do you mean by all that?
Well, you know, we have words in our culture. You felt emotional or he felt something. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is the difference between the felt sense and the emotions. And in a way, it's just vocabulary, but I think it points out different talents that we all have that our body is communicating to us. The emotions are fairly, you know, what you think, anger, sadness, joy, fear, so forth, very clear things. And there's a very clear physiology to all of that. One of the things I've done is look at and create a model of personality and experience combining the Eastern physiology and the Western physiology and neurophysiology. And so that gives me a fairly clear map to help people and look at things. But one of the things that we often turn off is our felt sense. You know, we can walk into a room, we get a sense of how the room feels, or maybe we're in a small group of people and somebody walks in that's either very happy or very sad or just pent up, and we feel that change. But our body tells us very clearly how things feel. This feels good. This doesn't feel good. I like this person, but I feel uncomfortable with this person. I feel comfortable with this person, but, you know, it's hard for me to do something. You know, I'm a guitar player, and I can pick up a beautiful guitar, and my hands feel numb, and I can pick up another guitar, and all of a sudden my hands just fail. They do things I hadn't thought they would. Well, you know, we have a way that we interact with people and with situations. So I call that the felt sense. Now, a lot of us grew up in families where we weren't supposed to feel certain things. Some families switch. Some families don't want to feel sadness, so they feel anger or whenever something tender comes up. Some families don't want to feel angry, so they feel sort of, they cry a lot whenever something powerful comes up. And sometimes people just, you know, a lot of families live a lie. They look like they're happy, but they're not, that they're suppressed. So all these experiences, and of course many, many others, create a numbness, a density. And when we start to open that, our body gives us incredible information. You know, you can be at a restaurant. You can go down the list. You can say lasagna, spaghetti, Cobb salad, hamburger, you know, organic veggies. And if you pay close attention, right in the upper part of your abdomen, there'll be a slight shift in how that area feels. It's kind of or some similar situation. Your body will tell you exactly what it wants. Of course, your head can say, "No, I really want ice cream." but it's even with ice cream. If you take a bite, and there's that first really good feeling, but then if you pay really close attention, the second bite doesn't feel quite as good. So if you're eating for nutrition or you're eating for sensation, a bite or two is good. If you're eating to kind of numb yourself emotionally by the sugar and the cream and all that so you can't feel anything in your epigastric area, then you keep eating beyond those messages that your body gets. And that's one of the things our society is so intense that we eat just to calm down.
Sure.
Or eat or buy or whatever it is. Yeah. We do things that create stimulation in the brain, in the dopamine centers, the pleasure centers of the brain. But there are ways to get beyond that. And we get beyond it by looking clearly at what the physiology is. There's a physiology of the felt sense. There's a physiology of the emotions. There's a physiology of all these different emotional states. The previous caller was talking about anxiety and depression. Anxiety actually has to do with the organ of the stomach itself. And if you just actually breathe into the upper part of your abdomen or put like a hot water bottle up there, you're going to find that the anxiety will change in a minute. Now, that doesn't mean you're done with it for life. You have to sort of get used to that. But there's a really clear physiology. We can talk about depression. There's many kinds of depression in Chinese medicine, and I've discovered some other ones. But you know, there can be depression where the heart gets shut down. Generally, if we take the word depression and we change it to suppression, things held in, things held tight. They're held in so much and so tightly that we can't move, and so we feel depressed. And once we begin to move those things, once we begin to make it okay to feel those things and realize that it's safer to feel them, not to feel them, that they don't overwhelm us, that they don't take away our power. In fact, they re-empower us. when we get used to feeling them, then it becomes really beautiful experiences rather than overwhelming. Now, obviously, if your child dies or some calamity happens, it's not a beautiful experience. But the depth of humanity has powerful experiences. And that's part of our sole purpose, is to begin to keep our place no matter what's happening, experiencing it without losing yourself. And this comes back to the physiology.
Okay, let's go to the phones, okay?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Johan in Kankakee, Illinois, to get us started. Go ahead, Johan.
I used to read the books, you know, by Timothy Leary and the Dr. Richard Alpert and the Harvard professors in the 1960s. And one of the of Alpert's gurus said that the use of the psychomanergic medications is really just a gateway to reality that are beyond the drugs. So it's just a tool of chemistry, and but you can find out if you are going to see the good and or the evil, but you want to get beyond those to live a life that is more happy. So I want to hear a comment maybe about I'm so nervous, but I just want to wonder if you can say something about if maybe these things can be a tool to see a reality that is beyond the difficulties of the present. Thank you.
All right. What do you think of that, Peter?
Well, they definitely, you know, can take us beyond. You know, in the early days, with a lot of us, I had a fair amount of experience with a lot of those substances. And they changed me. Of course, I don't know how I would have been if I would have gotten to the same place without them, because I did them. What I did find is that when I was doing long retreats in the Himalayas, months at a time, doing 8, 10, 12 hours a day or longer of practice, I got to states that were as psychedelic as anything that I had taken chemically, but that there was a different kind of integration, that they didn't burn me out. I didn't have to recover from them. And the insights that I got stayed with me. Now, that could have just been me. You know, I have many friends that are very involved, and I know some people high up in the research, and they swear by them. Stan Groff was nearby, and so forth. So a lot of people, you know, are very positive about them, and I think that under the right situation, they can be very powerful medicines, very powerful doors. But they are very powerful, and so it's important to just like doing any advanced practice, you need to be grounded, you need to have a sense of yourself, you need to have a sense of balance a little bit, so that you can hold on while these things move and work through you. And, you know, it takes preparation, just like going into a spiritual retreat. You have to have some foundation in the practices, you have to know what you're going to do, you have to have a sense of reference. And so I think that sense of reference is important, although sometimes we have to lose that sense of reference and go beyond. We want to make sure that if it's important that we can come back. And so I think it takes help, and it takes guidance by those that are more experienced than us, if that's what we're going to do. And if we're deeply depressed or deeply anxious, or, you know, we're in an unstable emotional state, I really would think twice about it until you got a little bit more calmed down or had somebody that was very knowledgeable to help.
Is it a sign of weakness, or, you know, is it vulnerability if you're too happy, too caring?
Well, you know, there is a pathological state in Chinese medicine where people are laughing about things that are not funny. Like, oh,
somebody falls down the steps or something, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes that's, you know, sometimes, you know, you can cry things, you can laugh things. It just depends on what organ it's releasing from. Sometimes, you know, sometimes if you fall down and you laugh, you're realizing that, you know, oh, that was kind of stupid, and you're not taking yourself too seriously. But if say somebody, like my father just died, where there's a laughter that's completely disassociated from the reality, this is actually a sign of a energetic problem with the heart and the pericardium in Chinese medicine. You know, most of these aberrant states are mapped out fairly clearly and show us really where the imbalance is or the balance is in someone. So, you know, obviously it's important to feel the reality of things without getting sucked in too far.
To the phones, Mark in Sarasota, New York, east of the Rockies. Hey, Mark, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you, George. It's actually Saratoga, famous for a racetrack in the battlefield. Anyway,
sure is.
George, it's an honor to speak with you, a longtime listener. And Peter, I love you. I love your message that you're getting out there. And I thank you for the time you're taking to put that message out. I only hope that people listening tonight are able to fully open up to this message. Quickly, my story is I've been riding the waves of depression from an unknown origin since I was a young kid. And I was suicidal many times throughout my life, up until about the year 2002. A couple things happened to me. I had a dream in which I was driving home one night from work. Very realistic dream. I was coming to a stop sign going down a hill, and I looked over, and there was a figure sitting next to me with a white robe, long flowing hair and all that. And he looked over at me and said, "Everything is going to be okay." And in that moment, I felt at peace, completely at peace, like I've never known before. And I started coming to the stop sign. When I got to the stop sign, I heard the wail of all three of my children crying, the worst cry you've ever heard in your life. And that crying was me coming to my end, actually having committed suicide. When I woke up, I felt completely at peace, and I never felt suicidal again. I mean, I've had thoughts, but never to the extent I did back then.
Jeez.
So a couple things have kept me going over the years. A, the fact that the body is going to die, but because of my reincarnational beliefs, I don't believe in death. That's helped keep me going. The fact that I'm going to die someday, my body is going to die. But I think we're here for a purpose. I think we're here to learn. I think the struggles that we have in life are good for us because we are here to learn from them and get better as we go along. Your message, there's so many things I could say right now listening to you and all the things that you've brought up. I know my time is kind of short here. I want to go on for other listeners. I really appreciate your getting the message out there.
Well, thank you. You know, it sounds like you had a beautiful, beautiful experience. I've had a similar experience, not being on the edge of suicide. But suicide is a very interesting phenomenon. I spent a lot of my late teenage years feeling somewhat suicidal. And I realized that whole quality of being suicidal is a place where we're so stuck on the inside, we can't go down into it. We can't get up away from it. It's that place inside us that just won't budge.
It's dangerous.
And that's what feels so terrible, because it's the opposite of life. Life moves and feels and sways and interacts. And when we are just so stuck inside, there's nothing to do but try to end it. I've experienced that feeling. But it's interesting. All you have to do to get beyond that is to move, do something, think, feel anything, and just get things moving again. And that moment of feeling suicidal passes. And then hopefully you can get some help like you did, either from another dimension, a blessed source, or somebody that, you know, works professionally. You want to find somebody that, or obviously you've already gone beyond this, but somebody that really looks at the physiology. And, you know, so many of us try to heal. Years and years ago, I was working at a psychiatric hospital in L.A. I hadn't studied anything yet. This was, I don't know, 40 years ago or something. And I was walking down the hall, and I saw a client who was heavily medicated. And they were kind of in a stupor, and they had a toothpaste tube, and they were taking the end of the tube, and they were scratching it against their wrist. And I thought to myself, gee, there's something about that. I've got to find that out, because I was thinking of wrist slashing. Well, why are they doing that? Well, within the year, I began to study acupuncture, and I realized that those acupuncture points on the wrist relieve tension and anxiety and pent-up feelings in the epigastric area, the upper abdomen, which is where, if you really pay attention, is where most of those suicidal feelings come from. And I realized that it's, and then I started to look at the literature, 97% of suicides by wrist slashing are not fatal. And most people report a great reverie for several days afterwards. So obviously I don't recommend slashing your wrist if you're feeling suicidal.
No.
But I do recommend massaging it or putting heat there. And it's interesting, you know, if when I get a client that's cut, that cuts themselves. I had a young girl, I think she was 15 or 16 the other day. She was a cutter. And when I looked at her arm, it was all up and down the lung meridian, which is, and so the slight release of blood releases grief and sadness from the lung meridian. And then she had three cigarette burns exactly on the points that I would use to treat her. So, of course, the psychiatrist or somebody that says, oh, you're self-destructive, you have no idea what you're doing, well, you can't trust yourself. But yet, often, these deep, erratic behaviors have some intelligence behind them. And so whenever I'm taking the pulse, when I do a Chinese pulse diagnosis on someone and I see that scar, I tell them that story. Because they have to realize that there's a part of them that's not destructive. That in spite of what their mind or intellect or concept would say, there's a part of them that really wants to live and survive. And part of you that listened to that voice or connected to that source that was going to be okay. That's that same part. That's the same part that wants to live that is not destructive. So this whole idea of suicide is very interesting.
Let's go to Chris, Redding, California, west of the Rockies. Chris, go ahead. Thanks.
Hi, Peter and George. Good to talk to you guys.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, the reason why I talk about this is because it's been one of the only things that has made me happy in this life, and that's studying Buddhism personally for me.
Uh-huh.
And so maybe Peter can answer why that makes me happy. But the questions are that if I believe that I'm a bodhisattva, which has taken the four vows, which are to achieve Buddhahood, end all suffering, liberate all beings, and penetrate all dharmas, if I could actually be a real bodhisattva, and when bodhisattvas that take on these vows, when do they achieve Buddhahood, if you know? And I thank you for taking my question.
Well, you know, it's a double-edged sword or a razor's edge, as someone said, Mom wrote. You know, the idea is not to be attached to being a Buddha, because that attachment keeps you from there. But the idea is just that it's just to begin to feel with your heart the suffering of others and naturally respond to it. If we respond to it because we want to be something, we're disconnected from that compassion. Obviously, it's better to respond for a reason than it is just this natural outpouring. But as our heart becomes healed, and what becomes important is the experience of humanity and the relief and helping others that are hurting or feel bad or in pain or need comfort. When we're not thinking about accomplishing something, when it's just part of us, then we're pretty far along the way to being a bodhisattva. But the idea that you even want to be a bodhisattva or serve somebody, whether you call it that, whether you're in the Buddhist tradition, is not important. What's important is that you're feeling a connection to humanity, and in your own way, you're moving in that direction. You know, we all have so many limitations of how close we can get or how intimate we can get or how much we can really love beyond our own needs. So sometimes we have to have training wheels by these ideas and concepts that sort of take us in that direction, and then gradually they fall away. It's not important if I'm a Buddha. It's not important if I'm a bodhisattva. But when I see somebody in pain or hungry, I want to help them or feed them. Or sometimes when we get really wise, we realize that we can let them find it their own way.
What about people, Peter, that don't have compassion? At all?
I'll try not to make a political joke here.
And I've got 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. People that don't have compassion are people that don't feel humanity. The emotional centers that they have where we feel each other, usually the heart, is shut down from their own trauma or their own frontal cortex.
Are they happy with themselves?
I don't think so. I've never met anybody that was judgmental or limited in their ability to connect to others that really had a sense of happiness.
All right, stay with us, Peter. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Peter Fairfield, our guest, the book Deep Happy. We shall be right back with your final calls. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, it's going to be one of our classics. We'll talk about lucid dreaming and also forgotten civilizations. And when we come back in just a moment with Peter Fairfield, Deep Happy, we'll take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Peter, do you think all children are born happy little babies?
Well, I used to work in pediatrics, and I saw a lot of babies, and I think that not all of them are happy. I think that there's an essence in them that's happy. I think that when you look at the work of prenatal psychology, the work of David Chamberlain and so forth, what you find is that the babies are really start picking up family dynamics really from conception. You know, when you look at the biochemical interaction of what happens not only when the sperm picks the egg, it's a very, very karmic. There are so many checks and balances that have to do in there that the little beings are starting to adapt to families right away. And so if a family, if say the mother is using certain drugs or the family has certain emotional patterns or so forth, the babies pick that up. When my son was in his mother, several months before he was born, we used to play games. I used to put my hand on her tummy and kind of move it over, and then either his foot or his hand, I wasn't sure which, would kind of follow me, and we kind of try to fake each other out. So these are very conscious little beings. So they pick it up, and I think that their basic attitude of humanity is happy. But then we have these experiences that we have to learn. It's like, and especially if you're an older soul, somebody with a very wider view, and that's how I really define that, is the wider your view is, the older soul you are. And I don't think it's linear. I think we come in at different times with different purposes. That's not necessarily higher and higher and higher. But I think the whole idea is first we get screwed up, and then we get healed, and then we help others. I think that's kind of the path. It may not all happen in one life. But so I think babies are intrinsically happy, but they adapt early.
They sure do. Let's go to Bernie, Texas. Roger's with us east of the Rockies. Roger, you're on with Peter Fairfield.
Oh, Mr. Norrie, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Mr. Fairfield, I have a question or a thought that maybe you can help me on. I've often wondered, why does the human body feel that staggered intake of air and the tightness in your chest whenever you feel the urge to cry, whether you're listening to a love story or you're listening to a beautiful piece of music or you're happy or sad, you feel that common urge to cry? And I'll take your thoughts off the air.
Well, you know, the lungs, you know, which is really the organ of sadness and grief and loss in Chinese medicine, of course, are in the chest. And a particular, and you talked about a tightness in the chest. So a tightness in the chest actually is not normal. A tightness, well, it's actually probably normal, but it's not actually balanced. It you know, that comes from holding in. And when we find a way that's non-threatening, like a movie or a soft feeling in a book or something, it's easy to cry and have that release for some people. It's a different kind of crying. It's not so deep. It's like when I'm doing emotional work with somebody and they start to cry, I have to determine how, if it's real, because some of those people cry to keep away from very strong and powerful feelings. And that kind of crying is a ha, 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 and there's no involvement in the abdomen. When there's a ha, 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 and the abdomen is actually kind of pulsing and spasming, that's a releasing cry. And so sometimes the body is very creative in how it expresses itself and how it's been trained and how it can get untrained. And so, you know, we like those things because they make us feel. And the more we feel, probably the more human we are. I think that's been a theme tonight.
I think most people are generally happy, don't you?
I do. I do. I do at their core. I think most people are kind of kind. Most people get a sense of humanity. You know, I don't live in a war-torn part of Africa or somewhere. You know, I think that's probably very different if, you know, they're suffering. But I have spent a great deal of time in poor countries and Latin America. I've lived in the back reaches of Nepal and back reaches of China and the back reaches of India and so forth. And people are happy. You know, there is a aliveness, there's a connection, there's a community sense that even though they're dirt poor, or maybe they have to save up for dirt, but there's still a look in their eyes that says, I'm human, I'm okay. And I think that is a fundamental human trait for most people.
Let's go to Ann Paris, Illinois now. Go ahead, Ann.
Hi.
Hi.
Just after what you just said, this question seems kind of off, but why is it when a person is just tired of living and sees no point, why can't they close their eyes and make everything shut down?
And feel better?
No. Just
go.
Die.
Just go away.
Just die.
You know what? If it was really your time, I think you probably could. I think death's a choice. All my experiences working in hospitals tell me that at some very high level, death's a choice. But when we stop having, a desire to live, it's because we're so shut down generally. It's because we've stopped feeling. We don't know how to deal with, we don't know how to get beyond where we are. We're holding things in. We're holding in our will and our power and our feeling and our expression. And sometimes it just takes getting really, really pissed off and just you know, moving forward or going deeper into sadness, going deeper into hurt, and until you finally find a place where you touch it, and then you'll bounce back, and then you'll begin to recover. It's when we don't feel, we're in the state that feels emotional, it feels painful, it feels difficult, but yet we're pushing it away, in a sense. And so as soon as we can find something powerful and real to feel, it begins to kickstart everything else, and we can go forward. So, you know, my suggestion is if you can't close your eyes and die, it's probably not the right time, that there's still work to do and lessons to learn.
Peter, we've talked about happiness. What about sadness? Is that natural? Is that normal?
Yeah. You know, there was a great Buddhist teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, that said that the normal condition of humanity is sadness. Because we do feel each other's suffering, you know, whether it's, you know, a little child not getting what they want for Christmas or not getting something that they were attached to, or whether it's, you know, an older person losing their mate after a lifetime together. You know, life is sadness. You know, things end, things change, things dissolve. And so it gives us the depth of what we feel, as do all the emotions. But when we get stuck on one or we eliminate one that we can't feel, that's when pathology comes. I mean, feelings are a great way that we understand the world. You know, you can go out and you can watch animals with feelings. You can, as I said in the beginning, the amoebas seem to have feelings. It's the nature of life, and the different emotions relate to the different organs. In my thinking, in my research, and other people's research, so it's just how the different parts of the body experience, you know, reality and living.
Next up, we go to Tim, San Francisco. Timmy, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, what you just said, originally I was just calling to say, you know, I've been pretty depressed and low, and I've actually my whole life pretty much I've been diagnosed with so many different things. I don't even know what's wrong with me. But when you mentioned about the wrist thing, I actually started to, like, rub my wrist and stuff, like you said, and did feel more relaxed. But and that was originally why I called. But after hearing what you just said, it's interesting because, you know, people always ask me what's wrong. And the honest answer is I always say, I don't know, because I don't know what I feel. I mean, I can feel bad when I see, like, a commercial about animals that are abused, you know, something like that. But I don't ever know how I really feel. I just know it doesn't feel good.
Can I talk about you specifically?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Can I talk about you specifically?
He's gone.
Okay. Well, I won't talk about him because I didn't have his permission. But you can hear in people's voices, like, for instance, certain people have a quality in their voice if they have a same-sex parental bonding deficit, which sounds very technical. But if I'm a little boy and my dad is emotionally distant or gone or controlling or has a drug problem or something, I will shift my polarity a certain bit in my body. If I have the opposites, if I'm a little boy and my mother has those problems, then my polarity shifts a different way. And so all these patterns that we are grown up with are existent patterns in the body. I did 12 years worth of research looking at how the parental bonding experience shifts our energetic field. Like, for instance, if we have an opposite sex, we become much more linear, much more cerebral, much more direct. But we don't necessarily know how we feel, and that's when the energy is shifted toward the spine, to the yang polarity. If we have a same-sex problem or deficit with the same-sex parent, we become softer, we become more touchy-feely, we become we look like pushovers, but we're, you know, we are connected to what we feel. This is why Clinton, you know, was such a surprising guy, I think, to the Republicans, because he looked so soft, but his resilience was on the inside. And so, you know, all of these situations can be remedied and fixed, because they're part of physiology, and physiology can change and be healed. And so I think that's important for anybody listening that's depressed or anxious or sad. You can feel better. There's hope. I mean, not just me can help you, but lots of people can help you. So you don't give up. Really, you know, really search for somebody that makes sense to you, that has a heart, that has feelings, that you connect to, and you know, you can make another step forward. You can get out of whatever dark place you're in.
West of the Rockies, Jessica, Laramie, Wyoming. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a common question. I worked at a prison in Wyoming. It's called the Wyoming Honor Farm, and the entire point of this institution is for rehabilitation and reintegration into society. And it's actually quite a phenomenal place. There's all sorts of programs that offer rehabilitation and therapy and counseling for drugs and alcohol and everything you can imagine. And I was curious to see if he might know why, even though there's all these opportunities for rehabilitation and to better yourself, why people still continue to have problems with reoffending and getting sent back to prison. And I was curious if you had any opinions on whether incarceration itself is a positive way to promote rehabilitation and the pro-social behavior that we want to see outcome as the product of putting them in prison.
I thank you. That's a really important question. I think one of the biggest travesties in the United States is our prison system. You know, it's a quandary. You have a certain percentage of these people really don't belong in society because they're too destructive and they're too self-oriented. Most of the people that are incarcerated, you know, obviously most of the drug people are don't need to be there. There's a lot of other ways to deal with them. Problem is the correct therapy is not really utilized. I don't really believe that for certain behavior issues, psychotherapy is particularly important. Once you know your story and what you feel, you know, it can make changes, but people that have these behavior issues that are antisocial or that are based on theft or robbery or things that they perhaps learned as a child, it takes a lot more than that. You know, besides having to change and find their heart and undo a lot of the traumas that are in their body, you also have to give them a life that they can live and teach them whatever skills they need to live in that life and get them comfortable in that life. And, you know, I just don't think locking people up does it, especially now that we have the corporatization of our prisons where it's a money-making thing and they're deliberately, you know, changing the law so more and more people go to prison so they make money. It's a travesty. We should be putting that money into college and different kinds of therapies and research. I've always wanted to work in the prisons. I've never had that opportunity, but it's something I would like to do, and I just think we need to start putting some money. You know, I think judgment is one of the real cancers in our society. We make ourselves right and somebody else wrong, and we totally miss the boat. You know, either we're not understanding them, we're not seeing the situation that they're in, and we're not helping them to get better. Do we want to punish someone, or do we want to help them get better? Which is better for society? I guess I'm judging the judger, so maybe I can guess what I'm saying, but I think you get my point.
Stephen is a first-time caller, Eugene, Oregon. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, hi, good evening. It's a pleasure. It was kind of funny. You were talking about childhood, you know, children always being happy, and my mother used to always tell me that I never cried as a child. I was always happy and smiling at some point, I don't know, a year or so old.
Are you same way as an adult?
Yeah, pretty much happy and caring. But it was funny because she told me she gave me a sucker at some point, and I took it away from me just to see if I would cry, which I did. But anyway,
way to go, Mom.
Question. Yeah, I'm still a happy and caring person. And just a quick question. You know, I've dealt with my wife's issues and been through all my emotional roller coasters and survived all that. And but at some point, as you get older in life, is it just the wisdom of all that kind of makes you less emotional or more even keeled? Or I came across an article a while back that actually had a term they used to describe people who have gone through severe emotion at some point in their life, where it actually a brain mechanism turns on where it actually devoids them of that emotional response to avoid them going into that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's like anything, you know, if you rub against something long enough, it will hurt, then it'll stop hurting because the body doesn't want to feel it. But when you wake that thing up, it starts to hurt again until it heals. You know, it's not all the brain. You know, obviously the brain has great adaptive ability. We've all heard neuroplasticity and readaptation and rewiring of the brain and setting it up. That's not the question. But it, so much of what's attributed to the brain is also in the body, in the great Indian texts, the Vedas. It says the mind is the body. And so much of what's missing in brain research and why it's not hasn't been as successful as they'd hoped or psychiatry is because of these things that are in the body. So when we shut down to feelings and sense, we can kind of get number. So do you want to get more numb or do you want to get more sensitive? And do you want to appreciate the sensitive, that ability to be sensitive? Now, one very interesting thing is the older people get past a certain age, I think it's 55 or 60, they start to get happier. 60-year-olds are generally happier than 50-year-olds, 70-year-olds.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so I guess everybody else died.
They're still around. They're happy.
Yeah. But happiness, it comes with age. Everything else falls away, you know. It's not so important to have a Mercedes and a huge car when you're 80. You're just happy to get your pants up and to find your oatmeal, you know. So I think that there's a sense of the appreciation of simplicity when you're older that makes it easier to be happier for simple things.
Well, if you could learn that at a younger age, then you got something. You know that?
Yeah, that's
Peter,
right.
Thank you so much. Good luck with your book, Deep Happy. Anything new? What's after this?
Well, we're setting up Deep Happy tours around the country. If anybody's interested, they can sign up or give us their name, and we'll contact them, you know, from our website. And I have a couple new projects happening. Sometime I want to come back and talk about the intelligence of disease.
All right, very good. Peter Fairfield, The Work, Deep Happy, for Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.